Hello, welcome to Fair Use 101. Thank you for coming to spend an hour out of your precious DragonCon Friday to come and listen to a bunch of nerds talk about copyright. I figure we'd just start off with some brief introductions. I am Meredith Rose. I am a policy counsel at a group called Public Knowledge in Washington, D.C. We do consumer advocacy work on tech policy issues, and part of my job description is copyright and fair use and fandoms and music licensing, and if you ever want to hear an hour of just an unhinged rant about how music licensing doesn't work, feel free to hit me up after this panel, and then we'll just go down and talk to some of the other panelists.
Sure. I'm Courtney Lytle. I'm an attorney here in Georgia. I have a small consulting practice dealing mainly with startups and entrepreneurs, occasional artists through the Georgia Lawyers for the Arts, which if you're local and you can't afford counsel, look for them. Georgia Lawyers for the Arts, pro bono group here locally. I also teach at Emory Law School, and I do mostly intellectual property and small business law at this point.
Hi, Dwayne Gatesel. I'm a lawyer from Austin, Texas. I have an intellectual property firm, so handle trademarks, copyrights, domain names, licensing, litigation, all that kind of stuff.
My name is Donna Bartley. I'm an attorney in North Carolina. I handle primarily compliance counseling for companies, intellectual property, trademarks, copyrights, ethics issues. And since I'm bad in cleanup, I will give our panel disclaimer, which is we are attorneys, but we are not your attorney. So if you are looking for legal advice, you need to find your own attorney. Our comments today are for entertainment value only.
And not even really that, frankly. Come back for the 10 p.m. panels when we're all drinking, then we're funny.
I think we're funny now, but I'm easily amused.
So on that note, so a couple of things just to get things out of the way. Kind of the way I was thinking we would structure this is we talk a little bit about the parameters, like what is copyright, and then talk about, and copyright 101 is its own panel. It's a very large
Sunday
topic. So if you want to come for a more in-depth explanation of that, come and see the panel on Sunday. I think we'll just kind of go over the brief contours of what copyright is, then talk about what fair use is, and then, you know, we can talk a little bit freeform about what fair use means for things like fan fiction or cosplay, how this impacts in the real world, what the current fights are about this in policy land, which is where I'm from. We want to leave plenty of time for audience questions because this is a topic that people teach entire courses on at law school, and you still don't quite hit everything. So really, you know, what we want to do is be available to answer your questions, and I guarantee you guys all have more interesting questions than we will have, brain sparks to talk about otherwise. So, Courtney, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Since I get to wear my professor hat from time to time, I will do it now. And I'm not going to be able to do it back here. I'm sorry. I can't talk without walking around. It just doesn't work. Sorry, guys. I should have warned you.
Courtney and I have been doing some variation of this panel for 5 years now, and this is the full pace.
This is the full pacing.
It's part of the ritual.
They always have me set up for my panels, but I didn't warn them ahead of time. I have to hold it? Nope. Oh, man. They're going to make me hold one arm. You got the stand? They're fabulous. When I come in for the ones that I know I'm doing this in, they've got it ready for me because they know if I stand in one place and talk, I mumble.
No. Also, we get you on video that way.
That used to really twitch me out, but I'm used to it now, so we're good. Okay. Do I have y'all's approval? Can I do it from here? Okay.
All right.
We're good. We are talking about fair use only in a copyright setting, so I've got to give you like the 30-second version of what we are and are not talking about. Trademark has a concept of fair use. It is not what we're talking about today. Trademark is your brand names. Someone in here, I'm sure, has a Coke or a Mountain Dew or something like that. A soda with any label? Someone has. There you go, Chick-fil-A, hold up the cup. See that red chicken? We know where they got that cup. From across the room, I know where they ate lunch, and it's not because I know them. Hi, I'm Courtney. I knew they ate at Chick-fil-A because there was that big red chicken. That's trademarks. That's not what we're talking about. If anyone in here is like a really smart scientist and invents science things, that would be patents, and we're totally not talking about that. And there is no fair use in patents. This is just copyrights. Copyrights is books. It's art. Inexplicably, it's software. That's a different panel, too. It's the creative things. It's also, to an extent, costumes and characters and comic books and movies, which is where most of this comes in. So, copyright. If I hold a copyright, it means I have the right to keep people from copying my stuff. That's the short version. There are exceptions to this. There are things you're allowed to do in spite of the fact that I own the copyright to my notes right here. I own the copyright to these notes. You can't use them unless I let you, except in certain exceptions. Now, we tend to talk about fair use as one of those exceptions. It's not. One thing to keep in mind is that fair use is not like, you don't have a right to fair use the way you have a right to free speech. It's an affirmative defense to an action for infringement of copyright. So you don't really have a right to fair use until a judge says so. And we will talk in a lot of levels about different policy of when is a use fair and when can you take someone else's stuff and change it and do things with it, or as my clients tend to say, steal it. I'm the one who represents bigger content holders. I'm the bad guy in the room. That's why I do this part of it, so I can get something out without people throwing stuff. But so, as my clients would say, steal it, as most of the folks around me would say, creatively transform it into something else in a legal way through the right of fair use. The problem, the hugest problem is from a practical level. You don't know until the judge tells you. And it's a very expensive process. The law of fair use, as we will talk about to some great degree, is really murky and unsettled. And it often comes down to who has the best litigator. Litigators don't work cheap. So, I mean, you've heard the old saw about how much justice can you afford.
Sorry.
There is something to that in fair use. Before you get your heart set on using something and transforming it creatively, think about what are you going to do if they tell you you have to stop. Because chances are, if you're using something that lots of people like, that owner may already have lawyers. Do you already have lawyers? Sometimes that's the threshold question. That's the practical side of it. Let's talk a little bit about what the law does tell us. It should be a nice, straightforward analysis. There's a law, there's a section, and it says specifically some specific kinds of use, like criticism and parody and use in classes, classroom use, is protected as fair use. Yeah, and some professors have been found guilty of violating copyright law for using copyrighted material in their classrooms, notwithstanding an express part of the law saying you can do that. One of the cases honestly came down to whether the professor had made the copies, and this is at a time when we used to say make a Xerox, or if it had been done by the copy center. That should not make any legal difference. That was kind of how the case came down. The cases are wacky, and that's an old one. So even if there is an express allowance in the law, maybe, maybe not. Then if you're not in one of the express categories, there are four, count them, four elements, none of which is determinative. Oh, that's so funny. She's organized. I love that.
I put this together literally 5 minutes.
Yeah, but you knew what we're going to talk about.
And he had the slide.
Someone had to tell you these four factors. I win. I get to. Okay, first factor, purpose and character of the use, including whether it's a commercial use or for nonprofit educational purposes. If you're selling it, it cuts against you. But just because you're not doing it commercially does not mean you win. That's one of the misunderstandings. Oh, well, I'm not selling it. Yeah, okay, so part of one factor goes in your favor. Now, which factor is most important? No idea. They are all weighed in a squishy, unpredictable fashion. Our next one is the nature of the copyrighted work. Basically, is the copyrighted work one which is going to be more in the center of copyright, most creative, or is it like a textbook or a history book or something that is protected by copyright, but only kind of. Among the things that are not protected by copyright are the facts in your book. So if, like me, you write really boring legal textbooks, the only thing that's protectable is the way you express the concepts, not the actual concepts or the facts. So nature of the copyrighted work, if it's a factual heavy book, it's not going to be as protected as if it's a novel. Okay? Third one, amount and substantiality of portion used. Did you use the whole thing, or did you take a little bitty piece? Now, it doesn't always matter. If you take a little bitty piece and it's the only good part, you're still going down. If you take the whole thing, you may not lose, but it's working against you at that point, right? How much of the work did you, I don't want to say steal, but that's what I'm thinking really loud. How much of the work did you use? Okay? The example for substantiality is one of my favorite cases. Gerald Ford, some of y'all are old enough to remember Watergate and all of that. Gerald Ford, who actually was a fabulous person, an interesting guy in his own right, wrote a really long memoir. And of course, the only part anyone at the time was interested in was the little bit on Watergate. Yeah, someone swiped an advanced copy and published that chapter. And it was just a little bit. It was like 20 pages out of bazillions of thousands of pages. But realistically, it was the only part anyone wanted to read. And so he won the case, even though they had just taken a little bitty bit. It was the heart of the work. So that's your substantiality of the portion used. And then the effect on the potential market. This kind of goes into both the character of the use and this one kind of fall into the concept that many of you have heard of, which is transformative work. Have you transformed the work into something else? You'll notice that's not actually in the statute anywhere, but it's a big litigator thing, and a lot of cases turn on it. It comes out in how you use it. Did you just copy it and resell it? Yeah, that's not going to work. Did you use it and turn it into something else? That's more likely to work. And the effect on the potential market. Are you selling this thing in the same place that the copyright holder would be selling stuff? Or are you hitting a whole different market? Those are your four factors. Judges kind of weigh them in a nice squishy way and decide what this case is going to come out as. There is a lovely article written by Judge Story, a famous judge, 25 years ago now, I think the article was written, about what a god-awful mess fair use law is. I make my students read it because I like the article, so they have to read it. That's how it works. You guys don't have to. It's fun. He wrote very eloquently just how messed up the entire area of fair use was. He said, but don't worry. We've been mucking around for 10 years pretty badly with this, but any minute now, we're going to get it right. The law is going to solidify. It's going to be much more predictable. I tend to do transactional work. Transactional people really like predictability. I like to be able to know, can we do this, or are we going to end up going to court if we do this? My clients want to know that. We like to avoid fights. Litigators like to win them. We like to avoid them. And if you need a predictable law. You need to know whether something is okay or not. And Judge Story was saying, really, we're getting better. Any minute now, it's going to settle down. It's going to be predictable. It's going to be great. He wrote it 25 years ago, and I assure you, it has not gotten better. If anything, it has spiraled completely out of control. So I would have a better chance telling you who the next Democratic nominee is going to be than telling you if something would be actual fair use. And I know a lot about it. Okay. That's your 2 minute or 3 minute, maybe a few minutes more than that, overview of what we're talking about. But now you've got the basic information so we can talk about the policy stuff.
Thank you. Wow. Holy moly.
Thank you.
And they call it the aristocrats. So talking a little bit about policy stuff, a lot of, you know, fair use is one of those things where a lot of it takes place in the courts. You know, this is paraphrased slightly, but this is actually written in the statute in the U.S. Code, 17 U.S.C. section 108, if anyone's like, or 107, sorry, 108 has to do with libraries. If anyone's curious, you can just Google it. And it really does boil down to, as Courtney said, kind of a judicial sniff test. There's a couple of reasons why that is. One, it's sort of a I'll know it when I see it attitude towards fair use. Because, you know, we have acknowledged for a long time that the ability of someone to use a work in a way that we think is socially beneficial in contravention of copyright exists on a sliding scale. Where you really start to run into problems, it's sort of on one end you have a teacher photocopying a couple of pages of a book or photocopying an art print to show to their class. You know, that we generally consider to be very socially valuable. Parody, which is a very specific thing in copyright. Parody is not what you... Weird Al does not do parody. Weird Al is not parody under copyright law. He's satire. That's a different thing. Happy to rant about that.
Weird Al gets permission.
Yes, Weird Al actually licenses his stuff, generally, except for Gangster's Paradise, and that was like a whole
separate
thing.
That was a whole different issue. So
parody...
That's what I usually tell you guys to do. Ask.
parody is using a work to make fun of the work. And that is a very specific thing, and that's considered very socially beneficial because it's how we get a lot of social commentary sort of through humor. On the other end, you have whole-scale Xeroxing of Harry Potter Book 7, minus the epilogue. That is not sufficiently transformative to get you into a fair use space. So a lot of, you know, the problem is that this does not really comport with how people interact with media, especially online. You know, fandoms are kind of an extreme example because there's a lot of transformative stuff. The people who run Archive of Our Own, which just got a Hugo this year, yay! The Organization for Transformative Works. They are pretty active in copyright policy stuff. They're wonderful folks. And that's their whole MO is saying, is coming up and explaining to lawmakers, you know, look, there's this huge amount of, by and large, non-economic activity that is going on with, that interacts with copyright in a way that our traditional models about how we think and how we construct the law don't match up with. You know, the law was basically built on the back of this notion that it was a one direction of consumption. It was a product, was birthed, it was released into the world, it was consumed, and then that was sort of the end of it, that there was no bounce back, there was no, you know, sort of end interaction among the consumers. It doesn't really account for that kind of transformative interaction with stuff. So a lot of what we run into is, you know, music sampling is like a classic example. Hip-hop, the law did not know what to do with hip-hop. It still arguably doesn't. I mean, anyone who followed the Blurred Lines case in any detail, just what an absolute nightmare for everyone involved. This also starts running into problems when you have things like, we now allow copyright for software. And so if you are a super nerd and you follow the Google versus Oracle decade-long lawsuit that is now on petition before the Supreme Court again, which is not something that usually happens twice in a lawsuit, but here we are, that's now on a fair use question about whether or not copying someone's API or mimicking, re-implementing an API is fair use, which is probably the single nerdiest sentence I have to argue in my day job.
But I feel strongly about it, too.
We all feel very strongly about it. Yeah, that's bad. That's bad that we have to have this discussion. And we'll probably think for different reasons it's bad. But the short version is we have a copyright system that is fundamentally derived from the notion of printers' guilds. If you go all the way back in history, it goes back to the Statute of Anne. It was literally granting one guild the ability exclusively to produce books. And that was where it was the right to make copies. And that has expanded, but that fundamental notion of it's one direction, you have the person who makes the thing, and then other people pay to read the thing, and then that's the end of the transaction, maybe to keep the thing, and that's the end of their interaction. That is the model that copyright has been built off of, and it has been sort of duct taped onto that model. We just duct tape new and new rights. We almost never remove anything from the copyright statute. We're just constantly adding more and more stuff, including things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and anti-circumvention provisions. And now you add what is arguably a whole nother layer of law functionally, which is the content moderation policies of large websites, which as a functional matter end up dictating what is and is not fair use. YouTube has a much larger say in what is fair use as a practical matter for most people than the actual courts do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, happy to talk about this at length. I could go absolutely for days and days and days. Be very wary if you try to be my friend, because I will. There's a ton of stuff going on. It's all nuts. That's my short version. Just very informative, I know. Dwayne or Donna, did you guys want to...
I was going to talk about trademarks and patents, but thank you very much. So, thanks for that. No, the thing that I would, because what I see from copyright from a litigation standpoint is clients always want to know what the bright line is. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the few areas in intellectual property where there literally is no bright line. You know, it very much is a we know it when we see it, which I know is frustrating for clients and for everyone because you want to know, okay, I'm doing this, is that okay? Mm-hmm. And you really have to see how it's used, in what context, and actually see the physical manifestation of that in order to have any clue. And even then, it's kind of guesswork, which again, I know is frustrating. I had a client, for example, years ago, they were in the electronics space, and they came to me and they said, okay, we want to do this with our signage, and let me show you our golden arches. And I said, let me stop you right there. Burn everything that you have. Don't show it to anybody.
Change your name and move.
Yeah. Never, ever, ever. And they, but they tried to make the case that, oh, this is fair use. It's like, oh, this is funny because we're commenting on we're a new business and, you know, we don't have billions and billions served. Like, no. Absolutely not. So.
Yeah. I was going to say, did you actually want to bring up, I think I always think of the Charbucks case, which is, I don't remember if that was technically a copyright or a trademark
case.
That
would be a trademark.
Was that a trademark?
Yeah.
There was a, I do not remember it, so, like, you know, feel free to jump in. But essentially someone, a coffee roaster, made their own brand of deliberately burnt coffee beans that they called Charbucks because they hated Starbucks and thought it was, the dark roast was burned constantly. And they got sued, perhaps surprising no one. And they lost.
Naturally.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's all over the board because you also had recently the dog treat, dog toy,
Chewy Vuitton.
You know, and they got sued. And, you know, it went all the way up, and they eventually won. But what a Pyrrhic victory that you've spent, you know...
Way more than you've ever made on your dog treats.
Yeah, $1.5 million to show that you are right and to establish that Louis Vuitton has absolutely no sense of humor whatsoever. I mean, that's...
Which we knew.
Yeah.
Now, those are both trademark cases, so that's not actually this analysis. It's a slightly different analysis for trademark. And it still comes down to don't mess with Coke, don't mess with McDonald's, don't mess with the mouse. They will get you and they will kill you. Just don't go there. They have no sense of humor. Whatever you think is cute, they will not think is cute. And boy, do they have more lawyers than the four of us know.
Right. And this is why people in fandom with backgrounds in lawyers lose sleep at night. It's because those of us who are in the Marvel fandom are inherently screwing with the mouse all the time.
Yeah. Yep.
Donna, did you want to...
One of the things that occurred to me as you were talking was one of the issues that we run into, especially, you know, when we come to places like Dragon Con, you know, any Comic Con fandom convention, I hear people talk about, you know, whether their cosplay or their, you know, fan art or their fan, you know, fiction is fair use. And they're always like, oh yeah, I Googled it. I'm sure I'm fine. You don't need to worry about me. I'm fine. Like, please stop Googling, please. Like, there is so much bad information on the internet about what is copyright, what is fair use. I cannot tell you how many people I have interacted with who have gotten themselves into legal trouble because they believed what Google told them. It's never a good idea. It's as Duane said, it's always a case-by-case analysis. That is the only bright line, is that there is no bright line. So, you know, if you are the one dealing with this, or if you have friends who are dealing with it, please don't give them advice on Facebook. Please don't tell them to Google things. I mean, that's as an attorney, that is the thing that bothers me the most, is when people go to the internet for legal advice, because there's so much bad advice out there, you just get further into trouble.
And it's not just because these are kind of intricate issues to pull. Like I said, I do this for a living, and I probably can't tell you what the judge is going to rule.
Right.
I can tell you what he should rule, but I can't tell you what he's going to rule. But in some areas, at least I do know answers. It's not just that it's a complicated question. A lot of the information that's out there on the internet is just flat wrong. I mean, not just doesn't apply in your case, but is just completely wrong.
Right.
Think about how good you get advice when you Google your strange health symptoms. Everything's cancer. You're going to die tomorrow, unless you buy the drugs that seem to be advertised magically on your screen. Yeah, legal advice is worse.
Okay, so I think we wanted to keep it open for questions, because unfortunately the baseline of Fair Use 101 is...
Yeah.
So it's much more interesting for us
to
get questions and comments from you guys.
There were hands.
Yes.
Now they're all shy. you got to get the guy with the box. There's rules
in
here.
Somebody first, Matt.
We live in a society.
And you have to be able to catch. If you drop it, you don't get to answer your question. Ask your question.
I was just wondering. Oftentimes, when if you violate someone's copyright or something, they'll send you a cease and desist. If you, let's say, you're reckless and you do something that gets the attention of the mouse or whoever else, and you stop after the cease and desist, are you usually okay? I'm just saying this because oftentimes people just put something out onto the internet where you can't really take it down, and if you just do it and then you obey the cease and desist, are you okay then, or are you still in for more trouble?
Well, it depends on the company. However, I'll tell you from experience, most of the time when my clients get cease and desist letters, if they comply and say, thank you very much, we won't do it again, that tends to be the end of it, because nobody wants to put their lawyer's kids through college for them.
So litigators are the only ones who get rich in lawsuits.
If they really wanted to sue you, they would have started off with a complaint.
And that
just drag you right to court.
The cease and desist is kind of the
please stop
shot across the bow saying, look, cut it out or I'm going to have to get me. But please understand, and this is a place that I've seen lots of stupidity on the internet, there is no rule about what you have to, how many days you have before the cease and desist takes effect, or how many times you're allowed to ignore it before you actually are going to be in trouble. Some of my son's friends have learned that you ignore your mom the first 5 times she tells you to turn off the video game. My son knows better than that. He knows what happens if he doesn't turn off whatever he's doing when I tell him to. He knows better than that. My rule about a cease and desist is different, apparently, than some wishy moms. So you just don't know. But there's no law that says a cease and desist has 30 days to... Nothing. It's just a polite, we haven't sued you yet. Would you like us to or not?
Yep.
Kind of
letter. Also, it's worth thinking about it.
Right.
It's not, if they send you a cease and desist and you ignore it, they might just not, that might be the end of it. There's nothing legally actionable except to the extent that it's like, now they can come into the court and say, well, we warned him.
We warned him and they kept doing it. And so will they sue you? Depends on, do they have in-house counsel? You know, do they already have a lawyer on retainer? Are they really angry? You can't tell from the lawyer or from the letter because we write them the same no matter how angry the client is. But chances are, if you don't listen, there will be a follow-up.
Also, it depends on your reaction to that cease and desist. If you decide to fire back a 10-page letter showing how smart you are, my client's a lot more likely to sue you.
Yes.
Just because you're going to offend them, and no matter, even if you said, I'll never do it again, they're going to read something in your letter that says, oh, he's going to do it again. He just wants us to think he's not going to do it again. And so you're a lot more likely to get a legal response if you respond in that fashion to a cease and desist.
There is a trend on certain spheres of Twitter that when they get cease and desist notices, which some of which are totally frivolous, some of which are not, the response is to publish it and then put the people who sent it on blast. I cannot recommend this as a legal strategy unless you are 100% sure that it is a frivolous notice, because it's going to have that effect. It's just going to piss them off.
Yeah, don't piss them off, because then they're angry and have a lawyer, because a lawyer wrote it. So they are ready to at least pay us to write a letter, and that's, you know, several $100 right there for that letter. They were willing to pay us to write the letter. And they're already that much in. If you piss them off, you know what's going to happen.
And when you do piss them off, I have cards. So.
Guy up here was next.
I don't know how that. This is really cool.
Hey, this is the high tech panel. That proves it.
Okay, so on the social media platforms, including like YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, the amount of, I don't even know if it's parody or if it's satire that includes, you know, content from the big owners, Warner Brothers, the Mouse, is unruly. I mean, it's every day, and there's like hundreds of thousands of producers or content. I mean, how is it legal, and how can they sell t-shirts and money? Is it just because they haven't been sued yet?
So this is actually a really interesting, there's a couple of things going on. One, a good portion of it, I can't say statistically how much, is fair use, especially if it is criticism or commentary. So Lindsay Ellis, her YouTube channel, she does Disney, she does a lot of different stuff. She got nominated also for a Hugo this year. It was a good year. But she does, among other things, reviews and sort of narrative takedowns of Disney movies, and she uses clips from the movies, and that's criticism and commentary, and that is held up as one of the illustrations in the statute, which is to tell judges, hey, these are the kinds of things we think are probably okay. And so that is, you know, as we were saying earlier, there is no such thing as a bright line or a slam dunk, but that's about as close as you're going to get to a slam dunk of fair use. The rest of it is this really interesting sort of benign neglect that exists in fandom. We have hit a really interesting kind of tipping point where, you know, any minute now, if Disney or Fox or whoever decided they wanted to bring the banhammer down on some of this stuff, they could. They could put a lot of people out of business. You know, there are folks selling replica Captain America shields. They could be like, no, 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 and no. And they could do it, you know. At the very least, they could sue, they could scare people out of business, because who wants to go up against Disney corporate lawyers in court? And so what we've kind of hit is this equilibrium stage where, like, legally, your exposure is pretty high for doing a lot of fandom activity type stuff. Practically, your exposure is lower. And the difference between the legal and practical exposure is always a really interesting topic because it's something that shifts more or less constantly. You know, Disney could send takedown notices to YouTube for Lindsay Ellis for using super short clips, even though it is absolutely a fair use. There are lots of rights holders that do this. They just say, like, I don't, you know, sometimes it's, I don't like that because I don't like the criticism they're levying against my stuff. That happens with some alarming frequency. Sometimes it's just, I'm going to use a bot that just blankets everything that looks like it may match up to my work, and I just don't want it up here, and so I'm going to tell everyone to take it down. I'm not actually going to look to see if it's a fair use or not. There has been some... The short version is, like, the boundaries on that are always a little bit in flux, but we're in a stage socially where there is so much awareness around fan activities, and things like YouTube commentary and, you know, the entire existence of TikTok, where it would just, you have to balance it against the PR that they would get for trying to shut it all down. Or interesting case study, early, the 501st, Vader's Fist, the Stormtrooper cosplayers, have a really interesting sort of history with Lucasfilm. And Lucasfilm didn't really know what to make of them for a long time. And then kind of they settled into sort of a detente, and then Lucasfilm got bought by Disney, and then they kind of had to start the whole process over again because Disney's like, what the hell do we do with these people? And so the short version is it's like a soft norm at this point, but, like, legally, yeah, you're still pretty exposed. Practically, under the terms of, like, you know, they could take down Lindsay Ellis' stuff whenever they wanted to just by filing a notice. Yeah, that can happen.
On the 501st, they're kind of a very obvious version of it, and they certainly aren't subtle. They actually, and I don't know what happened after they had to renegotiate with Disney, but they actually had a license from Lucas to do that. And there were specific things they were allowed to do and not do while they were wearing the uniforms and things like that. So they were allowed to do it, and I think the first response was exactly what you said. What the hell? Who are these guys? What? Huh? But most content owners are smart enough to know that if you really make the fans who love you the best angry, your next movie is not going to sell as well. So you don't want to make the fans angry, but you don't want to let them either do scandalous stuff that's going to hurt your name and hurt your image, and you don't want them to sell stuff that you would rather be selling. So there's lines there that they care about the most, but the reality is, unless you have permission, like the 501st do, most of that technically is illegal. It violates copyright law, or trademark, or both in some cases. They just kind of let you. Now, if you want to wear your homemade Captain America outfit here, Disney's going to say, yeah, cool. If you want to, you know, rent yourself out as Captain America and do kids' parties, or worse, adult, and I mean adult, parties, they're gonna have a different feeling about it. And so you're doing the exact same thing, but you're gonna get a different result.
And it's also important to note, like, we pick on Disney because they own everything. But also because they own everything, the different brands under their umbrella have very different standards. For what they're okay with and what they're not. So there's an entire sort of subgenre of Disney princess cosplayers, and it is, even as someone who studies fandom, it is the wildest shit. the hoops that people have to go through, there is special fabric that is used to make the Disney princess costumes for the official characters at the Disney parks. You cannot buy this, but it makes its way onto the black market. And so there is a black market for officially licensed Disney fabric to make costumes. Disney keeps a real hard fist on that stuff. And then a lot of the things like Marvel, just kind of culturally from like where the fan bases have come up in these things, they kind of tolerate a different kind of interaction. So the super short version of this is it's all a gray area, and it just sort of depends on how tolerant the rights holder happens to be.
Notice we have not given you an answer to any of these questions.
I know.
We know that. It's not an oversight.
Thank you.
Yes.
So I'm a dancer, and I guess I have like kind of a two-part question. The first part is like, I mean, I dance to music mostly, solely. But my choreography is original, or it's, you know, improv. And so I try to post that to either YouTube or Instagram, where that's usually only like a minute, or Facebook. And then sometimes you'll get, you know, the notification that this contains copyrighted material, and then has a little explanation. Like Instagram has their own policy of like, this is what it means and for fair use, and then Facebook has one. And with Facebook, you know, sometimes it's like, I think that like mine fits under the fair use, and so I'll say accept it and like post anyways. And like Instagram, I've gotten, you know, a little bit concerned sometimes and like didn't post it. But I guess I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, choreography, like original choreography with another artist's music, and then also on that like policy that pops up and what happens, like, you know, if you're saying, oh, I accept it, I'm going to post anyways, like what is, I guess, the consequences of that?
Yeah, so a couple different things. Sidebar, choreography is copyrightable. It's a kind of squishy area of copyright, because like you have to have something fixed in a tangible medium of expression, which
is... Recording it counts.
Choreography is a little weird, because choreography copyright normally applies to like whole ballets and not just like one routine. So yeah. If you watched the lawsuits about Backpack Kid and flossing in Fortnite, part of it is that a floss is too short of a dance move to get choreography copyright. These are the things I get paid to think about.
She's cooler than I am.
I wouldn't go that far. So the music thing is interesting, because part of this is a business decision on YouTube's part. Part of it is the law. The law part is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which has a requirement that if you are basically an online platform, and I'm very simplifying this, but if you're an online platform and you host user-generated content, and a rights holder sends you a notice and says, hey, my stuff is on your site without permission, someone uploaded it, you as the platform then have to immediately take that down. And then if the person who posted it comes back and says, no, it's not, it's fine, you then have to immediately put it back up. And then you have to tell them, you two go to court and sort this out. I don't want to be stuck in the middle anymore. So that's the way, that's the mandate of the law.
It's kind of a choreography of its own.
Exactly. It's a burden shifting, which is, in fact, legal choreography. So this is, for a lot of reasons, kind of arguably the best solution to a really crappy problem about who do you put the burden on to monitor what is online. The second thing is YouTube's policy about this. YouTube's policy allows them occasionally to look at a notice and go, okay, that seems like bullshit. And say like, this is probably fair use. You know, part of it is them having to give you the hand wavy, I don't know, bit that we just did in slightly more intelligible speech. So the business decision aspect of this is that YouTube runs a thing called Content ID. And what they use Content ID for is basically, if you're a rights holder, you can say like, hello, yes, I would like to partner with Content ID. I will upload a sample track of all of my stuff that I would like you to do an ongoing monitoring for. I would like your bot to constantly be searching your website for anything that looks like it may be my stuff. And then I would like you to do, and then there's like a panoply of options, you know, it's like, always take it down. Notify me and then I'll decide to take it down. Just, you know, monetize it. Start sending me all the ad revenue. So if you ever read about like people whose videos get demonetized, in some cases it's the ad click revenue stops going to the YouTuber and starts going to the person who claimed the rights to the music. Sometimes for as little as like a 3-second clip. So a lot of the problems with YouTube and monetization are their implementation of Content ID and the particular ways in which they use it both as a way to monetize and as a way to monitor. And there's a lot of debate right now in policy land about should we force them to uncouple those two functions? Should you have like one system to allow people to make money off of the use of copyrighted works? And should you have another one that people can use to take their stuff down? It's a combination of like law and business stuff. But as a practical matter, like, you know, like we were talking about earlier, what YouTube considers fair use has kind of superseded what the law considers fair use for a lot of people.
And a lot of it has to do with what their policies are, but the legal side of that is your choreography is yours, so that's not a problem, but the song is someone else's. And if you're playing that song without permission, you're at either performing or copying or both, and they do have a right, should they decide to force you to take that down. With some artists, I mean, if you're using Taylor Swift, yeah, you're not going to get through to her. Small artists are usually happy if you ask them, can I use your work? A lot of them will say, yes, please, just make sure you identify the artist and the music. A lot of less music these days, but there still is some that's being released under a Creative Commons license, and they encourage you to use it, and there'll be a very clear label on there as to, can you use it only non-commercially, or do you have to give attribution to the creator? But there will be ways that you can use it. And something like that is going to keep you safer, is to either have permission from the music owner or use a Creative Commons piece that is meant to be shared. Or write your own music. That's usually a different skill set.
Yeah.
But technically, you're using someone else's song. And I'm thinking that if your clip is super short, then you may come under a de minimis exception or something similar, but I'm betting you're choreography is longer than a few seconds long.
Yeah.
So there's not much point of, look, there's my 2-second dance.
Sorry. Yeah, I can't floss. Don't look at me. I have a 2-year-old. I have barely been on the internet for 3 years.
I have a 15-year-old. I just try to stop internet use at all times. But so the answer is, yeah, you can't do that. The question is, does the owner care?
Okay.
But as she's saying, a lot of on YouTube is automated now.
So, if you go ahead and say post it anyways, and then they come after you and try, you know, do legal action or whatever, at that point, and that's not the cease and desist per se, but at that point, could you be like, okay, fine, and like take it off, and like, or would you still have to go through with the legal action because they?
If you want to fight it, you have to go through the legal dance. If you just want to leave it up until you're in trouble,
yeah. So there's actually, I think there's actually two things going on. It's because YouTube has bifurcated this process. So YouTube, they do this first thing when you are originally uploading it, and they'll scan it and be like, "Oh, this looks like it might be something in our content ID database," and then you can just be like, "Yeah, whatever," and just throw it out there.
Yeah.
The takedown notice is the part that the law actually requires.
Right.
It's like if you say yes, put it up there anyway, and then a crawler comes along and is like, "Hey, wait a minute," and then takes a takedown. That's when you get the back and forth, the end of which is.
Yeah. Right.
Y'all need to take this to court and stop making it my problem, says YouTube.
So I guess I'm asking on that end, like when they decide to take it to court, and at that point, so they're going to sue you, or they want to sue you, and at that point you're like, okay, you know what?
Like, then you settle.
Throwing in the towel, like,
when the time to give up if you want to avoid hiring lawyers is when they take it, when they do the takedown notice, and you just say, okay, yeah. And that's going to be the end of it for the most part.
Okay. Well, it's good to know at least like the difference between like the fair use and then like the actual takedown notice. Mm-hmm. Like,
no, I mean there have been stuff. There's been stuff that got taken down from YouTube that was adjudicated fair use. Like the most famous case on this is the Dancing Baby case, which is Lens v.
Disturbing. It was just disturbing.
Yeah. It was I'm not thinking the Ally McBeal Dancing Baby. It's Stephanie Lenz. It was a mom who took a video of her kid dancing to. Let's Get Crazy by Prince, and the Prince estate, which is notoriously litigious, took it down off of fair use. It was Lindsay Universal, and she was like, you can barely hear the song in the background. It's my 2-year-old dancing in a diaper. What the hell's wrong with you? And she got sued for it, and EFF represented her, and they got a fair use ruling, and essentially what came out of that was, in theory, saying like, yeah, there's a part of the law that says if you're a rights holder and you send a takedown notice, you have to like be reasonably certain that what you're sending it for is not fair use. And you have to at least think about that possibility before you send the takedown notice. And this is the only case that has ever said, yeah, no, they actually meant it when they put that in the law. otherwise, that portion of the law is basically dead letter. Like, there's never been anyone who has managed to actually take a a rights holder to task for sending frivolous takedown notices. It's crazy easy to abuse.
Hello.
Hello.
So knowing that there is law and there's policy and things change over time, as people who love fandoms and want to cosplay or interact with them in many ways, and also knowing that that can sometimes support works in continuing because we like the creative works, how do you think that we as fans can like interact with copyright or fair use and both and like push it forward to a place where it either is less murky or still like supports the creative work but still allows us to have a role in someone else's work?
So there's kind of two answers to that. One is the law answer and one is the social norm answer. The social norm answer is much easier, which is just to keep doing it. You know, we're in a little bit of a golden age right now. We're like, you know, friggin' Michael Sheen is like talking about how he shipped Aziraphale and Crowley, and he like read fanfic to prepare for the role, which is thumbs up.
I mean, your sweater is in good taste and is obviously a fan thing. I'm betting it's not licensed.
No. And the pattern was not sold. It was found free.
Technically, it's a violation.
Right.
If the rights holder goes after that sweater, they're going to look like ginormous jerks. And that's not what they want, but they could. What we can do as fans is, you know, wear the sweater. Wear it to Dragon Con. Wear it to work if you can get away with it. Don't wear it to a strip club.
Right.
You know, especially if you're performing.
Don't make a porno. Step zero.
Those kinds of things will shut you down in a heartbeat. And if the fandom is happy fandom, they tend to be happy to let us keep doing it because they do realize eventually we're the ones who buy the stuff from them too.
Right.
But, I mean, let's be real. I'm a big Star Trek nerd. And if they hadn't let us do our own stuff, there were decades where they weren't doing anything. And if they had shut everything down, there would have been fewer people to go to even the odd number original series movies that stunk. But we all went because we were still fans and we would still buy the t-shirts and we would still be huge dorks even if no one else wanted to acknowledge us.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon looked at The Expanse and was like, there's a fandom and they're like, you know, raising shit because their favorite show got canceled. Let's buy that up. You know, so it is a very visible presence now, and it's like, you know, you can tweet at your favorite actor with a piece of fan art. So I think on a social level, like, you know, making fan activity slightly more mainstream, I think has been like a real benefit in just keeping the banhammer at bay. From a legal perspective, it would kind of fundamentally require rethinking how we deal with fair use. And fair use, the contours of it, as messy as they are, tend to happen in individual cases in courts. And you tend not to get kind of sweeping judgments, especially ones that don't make, you know, that make any kind of coherent sense when taken out of context. They tend not to happen too often. So it would require a legislative fix. You know, there are always groups that work on this. My employer, Public Knowledge, works on this. EFF works on this. Center for Democracy and Technology is another group that works on this stuff. You know, in my dream world, if I had to redesign copyright from the ground up, I'd nuke a lot of things from orbit. One of them is how we write fair use, and I would make it so that fair use could be presumed in the absence of making money off of something. You know, is that going to happen before I die? Probably not. But a girl can dream. But so, yeah, I mean, I think engaging in the conversation, when there are court cases, OTW, that runs Archive of Our Own, they periodically will put out amicus briefs, which an amicus brief is what you file when you're not actually party to a lawsuit, but you just, like, kind of kick down the door and you're like, hey, court, I have something interesting that you should be listening to. OTW files a lot of those, and once in a while they will put them up for open signatures and say, like, if you're a fan creator, you know, we're filing this on behalf of, you know, 70,000 fan creators or whatever, and you can add your name to that list. So, you know, keep chugging, do awesome stuff, do awesome stuff visibly if you're comfortable with it, you know, and if you want to follow the nerds who have to do this all day every day, like, you should do that.
Thank you.
And I want to make sure that it's clear, though, not making money on it makes it much safer, but that's not in the, that doesn't, you know, make it okay. You are much less likely to get
should.
In trouble. It should, but it does not. It is one of those four, and It doesn't, it usually, if it's non-commercial use, it never gets to court, frankly, because no one cares.
Yeah.
But not always. You can't guarantee that, and you can't guarantee that you're going to win, even if it's non-commercial.
And
a lot of people think that if it's non-commercial, well, I'm not selling it. Yeah, that's nice. You're still violating
copyright. And some commercial uses are still fair use.
Yeah.
I mean, classically, the songs, a lot of our big copyright cases are about music sampling, and they're you know, you're making money off of it, and that's still fine.
Until it isn't. Lord Lons.
Howdy. I'm curious about small creators who are making original content, and it sounds like a lot of, you know, Disney and big creators have a lot of availability to police their copyrights. I'm curious what availability there is for small creators to police their copyrights, and whether big corporations steal or use their material with fair use or not.
Probably one of the first things that you should do is it's not very expensive to file a copyright application to register your work. I think the filing fee is about $50 for the work, and it's the copyright database isn't that user friendly, unlike the trademark database, but it is something that can be done online.
There is one now.
They're modernizing it now.
There used to be one.
They're in the process of doing a big modernization effort with Copyright Office too. So in a few years, it'll hopefully be.
Yeah, but I mean, it exists right now, so you can do it. So that's kind of the first step for the small creators, because if you have what's considered a timely registration, that entitles you to get statutory damages and attorney's fees against an infringer, and that's really the most valuable weapon that you have in your arsenal as a small creator to start with.
In terms of whether the big companies steal from you, as a general rule, I mean, there's exceptions. Hollywood is dirty. We all know this. But as a general rule, the big content owners go out of their way to never see anything that anyone ever has done that isn't their own. They, if you try to send them a manuscript, they send it back unopened. If you try to send them anything, they will, you know, do this until someone removes it from the office. And they go out of their way to not see anything because they're really tired of lawsuits of, oh, no, wait, that was my thing. I wrote it and sent it to you. And, you know, someone who wrote a vaguely, you know, boy meets girl novel that was stunk, and then they wrote, you know, West Side Story, and oh, that was mine. No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so they try to protect themselves, honestly, against the, you know, unsavory versions of a small creator. And so the chances of them stealing from you is honestly very slim, but the chances of them doing something that might look like yours, you know, if it's a good idea, has some other writer had it? One thing to know about copyright, this is more from the 101 panel, but just because you write a particular story doesn't mean that no one else can use the idea from your story. They can't express it the same way. They can't use your words or your pictures and your names and all the things that make it specifically yours, but the idea they can use freely. And if someone else even created the exact same thing but independently and never saw yours, it's not a copyright. Patent gives you protection against someone else doing the same thing without knowing about yours. If someone else invents the same thing that you did, as long as you invented it first and patented it first, it's yours, even though they didn't know about you. Copyright's not that way. If they independently created the same thing you did, never seeing yours, two identical works could in theory have a valid copyright.
There's sort of one caveat to that. I know in fashion and visual art, this happens a lot. Small visual artists will find their stuff printed on Forever 21 t-shirts.
That's because Forever 21 is a whole bunch of pirates.
Well, yeah, exactly. So
we know they steal.
Yeah, but you cannot copyright fashion. That's a whole separate panel. Anyway.
Inexplicably, you cannot copyright fashion.
Totally explicably. We'll find out that. Anyway.
Class, because they always want to talk about that. And I'm always like,
oh,
you can't.
God.
I don't know why, but you can't.
You just can't.
Get over it. You can't.
So I know that does happen with some regularity. I think the mechanism by which most artists have managed to avoid that is naming and shaming, which it seems to work enough. It's not great. So what you identified is actually a really interesting, very real problem, which is that it is super freaking expensive to bring a copyright lawsuit. So a lot of the copyright lawsuits you see come from record labels, they come from, you know, Disney, they come from studios suing other studios in a lot of cases.
No one else can afford it.
Because no one else can afford it. And, you know,
it's your fault.
It's truly an ungodly amount of money. There have been proposals on and off for a few years now to create essentially a small claims court for copyright, for small copyright creators. It's a really good idea. There have been a lot of problems with making it work practically, making it work without violating the Constitution and the separation of powers. Just by the ways in which people have chosen to try to structure it, there's been a lot of problems with the damages that are at stake. You know, right now, copyright, if you violate copyright and I'm a rights holder, I have registered my work and done a bunch of other stuff, I'm entitled to statutory damages of up to $150,000 per infringement, which is how you end up with the $8 million iPod, which is a great TED talk if you've never watched it. He does copyright math, which basically is like, here's how you're on the hook for $8 million for, you know, an iPod Nano worth of music. You know, that is another debate that we will be having copyright law until the cows come home. But the question is, like, how do you set the damages then for a small claims court? Do you just let people get back the money that they would have made if they had gotten a license? You know, photographers have to deal with this all the time. Their stuff is copied and pasted all over the internet. You know, photographers have it rough. The market has pushed the value of their work literally to zero, in most cases. But how do you do that while not creating something that is functionally going to be a copyright troll farm with a lot of really bad claims? So that's a debate that is ongoing. If this is something that interests you, again, Public Knowledge and EFF have been working on it. We've sort of opposed the iterations of it that have come out recently for various reasons. But it's definitely a live topic, and it's something that people are increasingly aware of.
You mentioned with written works the idea versus the actual expression of that idea, and I'm actually in software, so I'm curious about, I know it's a little bit of a weird gray area, like the intent.
Software should never have been part of copyright. It just doesn't make any sense.
We agree on something.
I know, so I guess it's kind of where my question's at. It's like the intent versus the expression is very tightly coupled in software, so I'm curious if there's been case law or if you got any ideas about how you separate that or what.
Yeah. That is the heart of the Google Oracle lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly.
Right now.
Yeah.
Technically, your code is a list of instructions. Instructions are not copyrightable, except that they are if they're software. Both source and object code are subject to copyright for reasons we will never understand, actually.
Fun fact, when you register a piece of software at the Copyright Office, you must print out the actual code and then send in 60 pages of it, minimum. In printer. Just straight up print it out and send it in.
But
they really don't know how to deal with this.
So saying how much of copyright covers that, how you express it is what's technically done. What you are doing technically is not protected. So the clever function is not going to be covered, whereas the elegant way that you expressed it is. They can't just copy your code, but they can make another code that does exactly the same thing, is what the law is supposed to be.
There's a recent case you might know, Dubay versus King, on the copyright issue. It's a brand new case, and it gets to this issue of idea versus expression. And the judge, it was actually very clever. It was one of those cases where someone said, hey, I came up with this first, and it was a successful movie that came out. And the judge said, well, you can imagine an example where, you know, the main character lives with his aunt and uncle in a rural environment. That main character leaves home on a quest. He has a metal companion that's a key to that quest. He's accompanied by a large, hairy friend. The main character is seeking help from a wise man, and the villain in each case dresses in all black and has distinctive headgear. So you have two films that all incorporate those ideas. Infringing? No. One's Wizard of Oz, the other's Star Wars. And it's a useful illustration. You can have all these ideas, but it doesn't mean that the expression of those ideas is the same.
Right.
And the court, I think, clearly set out those examples to make it at least understandable that the general idea, everyone can use the general idea. It's specifically how it's used. And the same thing would be true for the software. You know, what's specifically in there?
It's harder to say with software because it's not creative like Star Wars is, you know. So it's a, since all of copyright was, since all of copyright was meant to protect just pretty,
I
not
the
function.
Mumbling of 100 coders.
It could be.
No, so this is
Disagreeing and moving over now.
This gets at something really interesting, and I know we're running up on time. But this is the atomization problem in copyright. This is, you know, anything when you, a novel is a bunch of words. You can't copyright a word. You can trademark a word sometimes, but you can't copyright it. A character, which is something I deal a lot with in fandoms, characters are archetypes that we have built stuff up on top of. You can't copyright an archetype. You can't copyright the hero's journey. You can't copyright, you know, we as human beings, we tell each other stories using a common storytelling language that has passed down through generations, and that can be, you know, you look no further than the debate in sci-fi about how sci-fi has depicted women and minorities or hasn't depicted women and minorities over the last, you know, 60 years or whatever. You know, it can be very limiting, but it's also the foundation on which we tell stories. And so the question is, how much of that can you protect? You get into fascinating situations where, you know, the lawsuit about Sam Spade, the detective Sam Spade, where Dashiell Hammett had licensed out Sam Spade to one movie studio and then turned around and licensed out Sam Spade to a different movie studio to make a different movie. And the two studios sued each other over this. You have some James Bond is currently in the public domain. Only very early James Bond is in the public domain. All of James Bond is not in the public domain. So if you want to do your own James Bond, you can do that. You just have to use only the version of James Bond that existed prior to 1923. So there's, you know, you can do Sherlock. You can't do the BBC Sherlock. You can't do the Elementary Sherlock. But you can do a straight up Arthur Conan Doyle based Sherlock. So it's this like fascinating question of, at what point does something become sufficiently elaborate that we're like, yeah, that's creative enough, that's expressive enough, that taken as a whole, it's fine, but people can still poach from individual elements at some level. So yeah, that I mean, that is the core existential crisis of copyright.
That one's fun though, the idea versus expression. If it's coming to, if you want just kind of the smell test for what you can, in effect, get away with, if you're making your own character, make it detailed. If I can recognize, I mean, I recognize her sweater. I know what this is. This is not official. I can tell you it's not official licensed goods, but I recognize exactly what that's supposed to be. It's a really cool sweater, by the way. That would be a violation because I know what character she's supposed to be. So if you're trying to say, oh, well, I changed the hair, so that makes it not...
OC, do not steal. TM.
Yeah, if I recognize it, it's detailed enough. If it's just the good guy or the hero, those elements are in everything.
In conclusion, copyright. So thanks for coming out.
Don't forget to rate us on the app.
Rate us on the app.
Well. They're not saying especially rate us well.
Rate us well.
If you didn't enjoy this, don't rate us.
Yeah, then you can just go to the next panel.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. I think all of my copyright panels, I'm just going to have to edit from that one.
I like that.
Copyright.